Hip Tranquil Check number 2, October 3rd, 2005. This is Kimberly Wilson. I'm here interviewing Darren Main, one of the top yoga teachers in the country, to discuss how yoga is a lifestyle for the modern yogi, especially for the Hip Tranquil Check. You can learn more about Darren Main at darrenmain.com, and you can view today's show notes at tranquility.blogspot.com. That's Tranquility without a Y, tranquility.blogspot.com. Hi there. I'm here with Darren Main, who is a well-known yoga teacher from San Francisco. He's the author of several books, including Yoga and the Path of the Urban Mystic, and travels extensively in the U.S. and abroad, offering workshops, lectures, and teacher trainings. He was actually here in D.C. this weekend offering a restorative teacher training. Welcome, Darren.
Hi, Kimberly.
Great to have you.
It's good to be here.
So in your book, you write, "Life is like a yoga mat." This is my favorite quote. I read this all the time in class. "Each circumstance in which we find ourselves is like a pose. Some poses are hard to hold, others are pleasant. But it is how we hold the pose that determines whether or not we will suffer or grow, and whether or not we will listen to the drama of the ego or the wisdom of our spirit." So what exactly do you mean by that?
That's a good question. I think that we start our yoga practice most often to improve our physical health, to deal with injuries maybe, or just to get stronger or more flexible. But when we really get serious about yoga, we start to look at it as a transformational tool. And that starts on the mat. We start to hold these difficult, challenging poses and respond to them in new ways. Instead of freaking out every time we feel a little bit of discomfort in a pose, we have the opportunity to respond differently. And eventually, and usually pretty quickly after we start our yoga practice, that translates into our life. So we find ourselves in a traffic jam, and we, instead of giving somebody the finger, we can smile and wave, or just breathe and enjoy the process, instead of going into that place of drama.
Right. So the ability to move through challenging poses in on the yoga mat also can translate, as you're saying, into off the mat, of just realizing difficult situations, moving through those, and just being more aware and accepting of discomfort.
Yes.
Then where do you take that? How do you get to actually transforming past the discomfort?
Well, I think that the Buddha taught that life is suffering, that as long as we're here in these bodies, we're going to have challenges. They may be in our relationships, they may be at work, they may be in our commute to work, they may be in our health, or political or social, whatever. But we're going to suffer, we're going to be challenged by life. You're not going to escape that. And so the only thing we can change is how we mentally respond to it. You can respond with drama, freaking out, feeling like a victim because life is not always fair. Or you can respond from a place of peace. And that is the transformation, not to make life pain-free, but to not go into a tailspin every time things don't go your way.
And don't you feel that, honestly, it seems like I've read this and I like to believe this, that if your life is very smooth and you're not having challenges, then you're not challenging yourself enough. You're not getting out there enough. You're not trying enough new things. You're not actually growing if your life is just this smooth kind of peaceful place that is never, you're not having the ups and downs.
Well, I think if you look back over your life and you think about the times when you've grown the most, it's usually when you made the difficult choices. The choice to end a bad relationship is never an easy one, but frequently it's the right one, and frequently a lot of growth happens from that decision. The choice to quit the job that you're no longer satisfied with, or to start a new yoga practice. Mm-hmm. When you're walking into a room and you're the only one there who doesn't know what downward dog looks like, or your heels don't touch the floor. Those are all difficult choices that put you into uncomfortable places, but they're also the most rewarding ones. People who stay in the comfort zone, who never want to be challenged, don't really grow.
Exactly. No, great point. And one thing you mentioned at the beginning is that many people start their yoga practice to become more flexible, to become stronger, to kind of just get more in touch with their body. And I've always struggled with people who say that that's not valuable. I feel that starting a yoga practice for any reason, whether you're seeking enlightenment or you just want to tone your body, is a beautiful reason to start yoga. You're at least on the yoga mat. And how do you feel about people's intentions as to why they begin a practice and whether or not people are ultimately going to be affected in a positive way?
I think of yoga like a spider web. And there's many threads on that spider web, physical health being one of them. A clear and quiet mind being another one. There's whatever reason you choose to start doing yoga for, whether it's to get that beautiful yoga body or to get that serene yoga mind or to work through the emotions that are coming up in your life or because your best friend dragged you or your boyfriend or girlfriend dragged you to class, whatever gets you there, you may start by working on that yoga body and healing your body and strengthening your body. And you can stage us there. There's nothing wrong with that. On the physical benefits alone, yoga is well worth the time and effort and money that you're investing in it. But very few people stay there. Whether they do it consciously or not, people right. start commenting that, wow, you're more peaceful than you mm-hmm. used to be. You're so much easier to tolerate. Mm-hmm. I actually like being around you. What right. changed?
I started doing yoga.
Yeah. I went to tranquil space.
Exactly. Yeah, no, perfect. So your book is called Yoga and the Path of the Urban Mystic. And that's something that really drew me into your book. What exactly is an urban mystic?
Well, urban mystic is a term that I sort of coined for myself. In years past, if you wanted to be a mystic, if you wanted to practice yoga or any other form of mysticism, whether it was Kabbalah or Christian mysticism or shamanism, you were really separated from society. You were put into an ashram or a monastery, or you went and lived your life out in a cave, and only then would you have access to these techniques. Nowadays, we've got people practicing yoga and Buddhist meditation and all kinds of other things, but they're not removing themselves from society. Right. They're having families, jobs, cell phones, pagers, commuting to work, getting involved
jobs.
In politics and social issues and whatever. And my belief is that rather than deny those things and call them bad or say they're not consistent with a mystical life, a yogic lifestyle, that we can make those things our spiritual practice. What could be more profound or more challenging than raising your children or running a business or working on a social cause that you feel passionate about, mm-hmm. or driving to work? It's all a yoga pose. Like the quote you read from the book, life is like a yoga pose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether that pose is your social activism or your work or your playtime, if you can do it consciously, the food you eat, if you can make every meal you have a form of meditation, where you're consciously choosing what food to put into your body, and to sit down and slow down and eat, that's yoga. That's mm-hmm. spiritual practice.
Right. Yeah, because I think you hit something important about the removal from society with regard to being an urban mystic. Because I would think it would be easier to be a strong yogi or to be a passionate meditator if you were away from the modern society. But most people can't do that. And we need these people in our society actually helping others and bringing the teachings to others. And so I like the blend of the urban and mystic.
I remember when I was a child, I was raised in a Christian church, Roman Catholic, and there was a stark difference between going to church on Sunday and the way we behaved every other day of the week.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that yoga falls, for many people, it falls into that category of, I'll go be spiritual on the yoga mat. I'll do my yoga practice and my meditation, and then I'll go live my life. And I think that spirituality, while it's important to have that time of centering and gathering yourself, I think that it doesn't end when you leave the mat or when you leave the church pew or the meditation cushion. I mean, that's where the real work begins.
Absolutely. But I think the important thing to remind our listeners is that we're all human. And that while, you know, as yoga practitioners, I think we do strive to live a more conscious life, that, you know, none of us are perfect.
Except
for Darren, of course. But I think it's funny because even going back to the church, you know, how you and I were both raised, you know, our preacher was always held to a much higher esteem than anyone else. Yeah. And I think it's good to remember that everyone is human. Yeah. So what does being an urban mystic really look like to you? Say, in modern day San Francisco living, how are you an urban mystic?
Well, that changes from day to day. I mean, it usually includes some form of a daily practice. Either I get up and meditate or do some asana work, yoga practice. And it also includes really this constant sense of self-examination. Like you said, we're all human. And my belief, the yamas and the niyamas are the moral and behavioral codes that the Yoga Sutras outlines. And a lot of people look at them as black and white. You're either telling the truth or you're not. You're either being nonviolent or you're not. And I think that it's this constant self-evaluation of saying, how can I be a more loving, compassionate person? Because we're never really done.
Right.
You know, as long as we're here, we're alive, we're struggling. We're struggling to harm and create less suffering, harm less and create less suffering in the world. And maybe that's changing your diet. Traditional yogis are vegetarian, but not all. And that's not the only way to practice ahimsa or nonviolence. Or to be more truthful with yourself and with others. And that's a constant effort. So just going through your life and looking at where you feel out of balance, where things are not working as smoothly as you'd like, and working to adjust that, to live more consciously.
Right.
And some days we hit the nail on the head, and other days we sort of miss the mark pretty significantly.
Right.
You know?
Bonard has joined us. We have our lovely cat on the kitchen table with us in our studio. So if you hear a little jingle, that's our friend Bonard. So you've been successful as a yoga teacher in San Francisco. And do you find that there's any conflict with making money, so making a living actually, but also being a spiritual teacher?
It's interesting you ask that, because I have struggled with that a little bit. But the truth is, people have been making money off spirituality for a very long time. And traditionally, at least in my observation, you know, you go to church and they don't charge money to get in the door, but the basket comes around and everybody's sort of looking to see how much you're putting in.
Right.
I feel like, first, I don't think as spiritual teachers we should be turning people away. I think there's lots of ways we can do pro bono work, we can do work exchange, we can do things to help anyone have access to what we're offering as teachers, as yoga teachers and whatnot. But that said, I think that we do live in the real world and we do have to pay the rent. Tranquil Space, your landlord isn't letting you run that, just shack up
just
there
cause.
And just teach yoga classes without paying rent. There's
right.
bills to pay, there's electricity and heat and feeding and clothing yourself and buying hip tranquil chick clothing and you know, all those important things.
Absolutely.
And so we have to be honest with ourselves about that. And I think it is more direct and honest to say, as somebody's walking in the door, this is what I charge for my services. So it's very upfront. There's no guilt or shame about it. It's just, you know, this is what I charge for a yoga class. And if you can't afford it, we'll figure something out, you know? But I think living as a yogi means being direct and honest with people. And frankly, no one questions, if I were to go to work at Enron and, you know, cheat people out of their retirement and do all these nasty things and become very wealthy, our society applauds that, right? If you're to go to work for a big corporation that's sort of raping the environment and, you know, stealing little old ladies' retirement money, nobody seems to have a problem. No one questions you. So, do you feel guilty about making all the money you're making? but you go to work as a minister or a yoga teacher, a meditation teacher, and how dare you make money making the world a better place? So I think we need to look at that. What do we value as a society? Do we value people who bring healing and support people in their spiritual growth? Hopefully that's changing.
But, right.
You know, it is a fine line to walk, though, because obviously a lot of spiritual leaders, ministers, you know, the televangelists, you know, they haven't been honorable in the way they've conducted their business. And that, of course, leaves a sour taste in everybody's mouth.
Right. Yeah, well, I think you raise a good point with that, though, also, is that, just as I mentioned earlier, that there's ethical standards that certain people are held to. I think everyone in general. I mean, I think most people were pretty disconcerted with the Enron story once it came out.
Mm.
You know, but I think, you know, if you think of yourself as a spiritual teacher, as I like to think of, I don't know if I think of myself really as a spiritual teacher, but maybe somebody seeking to inspire others. But are there ethical guidelines that you follow with regard to this? You know, anything that keeps you up at night or that you stay mindful of in your daily interactions with students or with you know, people on the street? How does this being an urban mystic play into ethical guidelines in your life?
Well, I think there's two things. I think as a yoga teacher, we're professionals. And as professionals, all professionals, whether you're a lawyer, a doctor, an accountant, have ethical guidelines, you know, being upfront and honest with your clients and not cheating them and maintaining confidentiality if somebody shares something with you. And
right.
That's just basic professionalism and ethics in business.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we want yoga to be viewed as a legitimate profession, we should honor those standard ethical guidelines. But also as yogis, we have the yamas and the niyamas.
Right.
And like I said a minute ago, no one's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
We're all human, and we're all going to mess up from time to time. But to really try and live what we teach, because being a yoga teacher is more than teaching a stretch class. We teach by demonstrating. And if your students see you out in the world acting in obnoxious, immoral, unethical ways, that reflects not just on you as a person, but on yoga in general. There was recently an article called Yogis Behaving Badly.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, it details what some very big-name yogis have been doing, getting in trouble, acting unethically. And of course, that type of behavior, it hurts their reputation, but it also hurts other people's reputation. And I think we need to just really get clear on that, that our teaching doesn't, just as you're practiced and when you leave the mat, your work as a yoga teacher doesn't end when you leave the yoga studio.
Right, right. It's a very highly valued position. Well, but one piece that you brought up with the yogis behaving badly, I mean, I feel like it's really important to just going back to this being human thing, you know, that everyone... Somebody told me once, and it's always affected how I view things when I get upset about something someone does. And he said, everyone's doing the best they can with what they know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that that's such a powerful thing to remember, that someone has upset you about something, to think that they're acting from their own experience and that they're really handling the situation the best they can. I think that that's a lovely way to think. I don't know if I believe it in all circumstances, but I do think that we're all just so unique and we're acting out of our own experiences with everything we do, with the way we've been raised, etc., that it's really an interesting way to look at it, kind of going along with the yogis behaving badly. Because it is, I feel like yoga teachers are being put in this position where they are supposed to be perfect. And people love to point out, like, oh my gosh, this person isn't flawless. Look what they've done.
Mm. You know, the only thing people love more than putting someone up on a pedestal is knocking them off
down.
Of it.
Absolutely.
And certainly yoga teachers, especially as yoga has become more trendy and popular and people are flocking to it, you know, people love to see somebody fall.
Right.
They love to point out, see, she's Miss Spiritual, Miss Yoga Teacher, and, you know, there she is cheating on her taxes.
Right.
Or whatever.
Yeah. And isn't that too bad? Because isn't that also
being
a bad yogi? You know, it's like pointing out other people's faults, you know.
Well, it's just... you know, it's one of the things, having seen this a lot, articles like Yogis Behaving Badly highlight some of the more egregious things that have happened. But I've seen a lot of gurus fall from grace and big-name yoga teachers who have done things that aren't quite, well, not very honorable. And they get into a lot of trouble, and there's a lot of disappointment, and people leave the practice because of that. One of the things I try and do in my books and when I give talks is use personal examples of my own struggles so that it's not about me projecting myself to be this all-knowing guru type. I mean, the thought of being viewed as that sort of creeps me out.
Absolutely.
But to use my own struggles as a method for teaching.
Right.
You know, it's like when you teach a yoga pose to your students, if you can show that, wow, I really struggle in this pose, and let them see that struggle, you give them permission to have their own struggles and know that it's okay.
Right.
And I think that's a far more powerful way to teach than to always have to be on as this perfect beacon of imperfection.
Absolutely.
You know?
I think that our imperfections are what make us even more fabulous. That's something that I really got out of the Pema Chodron books. I don't know if you've done much reading of her work, but it's amazing, you know, how she talks about, don't try to fix yourself. What makes you odd is really what makes you fabulous. You know, your idiosyncrasies is what makes you fabulous. One thing, though, that you just brought up is with regard to kind of like living a yogic life, like say you mentioned kind of like going out or, you know, living a life that doesn't seem to be in relation with your life as a teacher. But don't you think that as a yoga teacher in an urban environment, you can still have like an active social life? You could still go out. You can still do all these things that maybe if you see a student out when you're doing this, maybe a little shocking to them. Maybe they expect you to be home practicing on Saturday night. Yeah. Have you run into that?
I have.
Yeah.
Many times. One time I went out dancing at a big dance club. And I was just having a good old time. I don't drink and I don't do drugs. So I was just dancing. And a student came up to me in shock and said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I'm dancing." And he said, "But you're a yoga teacher." And I said, "And yoga teachers can't dance?"
Right.
And I think it was a lesson for him. But I encounter that a lot, this expectation that I'm somehow different from everyone else, you know? And it's unfortunate, and I think it's also good. And one of the stories I tell in the book is, you know, sometimes students will get that glassy-eyed look, like, wow. You know, they only see you in the context of a yoga class where you're all peaceful and soft-spoken and, you know, just totally 100% there for them. And she asked me if we could go out to dinner, and I suggested we go to Taco Bell. And she looked like her brain was sort of short-circuiting,
right,
because she figured we were going to go eat raw carrots or something. And I don't advocate eating at Taco Bell.
Right.
I think it's a pretty disgusting place. But I think it's good to just really let our students know that we are human, that we eat at Taco Bell from time to time, and that there's nothing wrong with that. As long as you do it mindfully.
Right.
It's the unconscious, you know, just mindlessly eating junk food that's the real danger.
Right.
And I think when we're mindful about how we live, we make better choices.
We consciously eat junk food.
Yeah. Or we notice that we don't feel so good when we eat junk food, so we naturally want to eat healthier food, which is different than just depriving yourself of life.
Right. Now, that's a great point. I remember, but when I had just started yoga, someone said to me, you know, they were talking about really noticing how they felt when they ate. And I was like, what is she talking about? I had never in my life, you know, observed how I felt when I ate. But then when I started yoga, it's really interesting. You definitely notice how not only what you eat, but interacting with certain people, how that affects you, if you feel good. or not good whenever you leave the interaction. Yeah. And I think that's all about your yoga practice off the mat.
Yeah. I often tell people that yoga will ruin your life.
Right. It makes you too conscious.
Because I used to be able to eat junk all the time and have unhealthy relationships and stay out all night. And I was a cigarette smoker, a chain smoker when I started yoga.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden it becomes sort of intolerable. Your standard of living, what you'll tolerate for yourself goes way up.
Right. It does, absolutely.
When you start to become more aware, it's like, wow, this makes me feel terrible, and I don't want to do that anymore.
Yeah. It's not easy being a yogi.
No. But it's a blast.
It's fun. It's fun being conscious. So as a fellow Hit Trinkle chick, Mr. Darren, what does being a Hit Trinkle chick mean to you?
Well, I love being a Hit Trinkle chick. I love your concept of the Hit Trinkle chick, and I think that women really are taking the ball and running with it. I was just in India, and women there are still not allowed to practice yoga. They're not. They're allowed to meditate somewhat, but not the way men are. And there's still arranged marriages, and women are still pretty much relegated to the home and everything. And in this country, women, of course, are allowed to do whatever they'd like. And yoga is very available, and they're flocking to it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're accessorizing. Olympia Dukakis, in one of my favorite movies, Steel Magnolias, says the difference between us and the animals is our ability to accessorize. And I think we see women doing that in their yoga practice. It's not just going to yoga. They have the great mat bag or the cool outfit. And they're really using that accessorizing as a way of celebrating their bodies, their spirituality. It's a reflection of how they feel about themselves to be more flamboyant and colorful.
Mm-hmm.
And you see men starting to come around to that as well. Women are definitely the forebearers in Western yoga. And I feel like men, myself included, are really getting in touch with their inner Hip Tranquil chick,
yeah.
You know? I don't know if I ever want to wear one of those spaghetti stop pink halter tops, but, or maybe, who knows?
Maybe.
Maybe I have one under the shirt right now you just don't know about. But I think the idea behind that, about living as a modern person, male or female, and really just celebrating your life is what being a Hip Tranquil chick is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's what being a Hip Tranquil dude is.
Right.
And I think that the lines between dude and chick are blurring all the time as women take on roles that were traditionally male and
mm-hmm.
men are staying home with the kids. And, you know, I think things are changing. And I think yoga and spiritual practice is a big part of that change. And so I'm proud to be a Hip Tranquil chick.
Or a Hip Tranquil dude.
Or a Hip Tranquil dude, depending on the day and my mood and
what color you're wearing.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you, Darren. Thank you so much for joining us tonight with the Hip Tranquil Chick episode number 2. Thank you for listening to my lively discussion with guest Darren Main. Stay tuned for more scoop on living a luxe lifestyle through yoga and beyond. Share feedback, stories, and insights with me at Kimberly@TranquilSpace.com. Visit TranquilSpace.com for Studio Scoop and view show notes at tranquility.blogspot.com without a Y. Namaste.